her fire drill appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court prior to the election.
In this very case, I mean, John Roberts sided with the liberals here, right? And yet the conservative majority was still able to hang on to a 5-4 majority, which is extraordinary.
Exactly. And he, you know, he sided with the majority or the liberals on the point of, that I mentioned earlier, on this mootness point. He's saying, listen, if this were to come back to life, if Cuomo were to reimpose this, the churches could come back to us. We should just sit tight and not jump in. And that's a conservative approach. But again, as you indicated, Justice Barrett, what went with the majority, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh weighed in separately in their own concurring opinions. And I think what we're seeing here is we're going to see an elevation of First Amendment rights over other public issues of public concern, because this majority, this conservative majority, is very, very worried. We saw this with Justice Alito in his Federalist speech this last week.
So, I mean, just in the few seconds we have left, if this was a moot question in the state of New York, was this a majority basically sending a message that these issues are very important? They want to send a message here?
I do think this is going to potentially chill states, governors in the future when they issue these orders, that they have to kind of handle religious institutions with kid gloves.
Kim Whaley, law professor at the University of Baltimore, also author of the book How to Read the Constitution and Why. Kim, thank you as always, and have a lovely Thanksgiving.
Thank you, David.
How many more people might President Trump pardon before he leaves office on January 20? There is a long list of people around the president who are accused or convicted of criminal activity, and yesterday he used his power to pardon one. Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had previously admitted to his crime. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas has covered the ins and outs of this case. Hey there, Ryan.
Good morning, Steve.
What did Flynn admit to doing?
Well, Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about conversations that he had had with the Russian ambassador in late 2016. Flynn went on to cooperate with Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation and provided a substantial assistance to investigators. But last year, Flynn changed his legal team, brought on new attorneys, and did an abrupt about-face. He started to claim that he was innocent and that he'd been set up by the FBI. He tried to withdraw his guilty plea, and then things got really weird. Attorney General William Barr got personally involved. He directed Justice Department attorneys to drop the case, saying that Flynn never should have been prosecuted. Critics accused the Attorney General of doing a political favor for a friend of the president in this case. The presiding judge refused to immediately drop the case against Flynn. That was challenged in court. The judge is still reviewing the case as of today. Now, all of that is moot because the president has gone on and pardoned Flynn.
Ryan, I want to emphasize what you're saying. The president had already bent the United States Department of Justice to drop the case for his friend who had pleaded guilty to the crime. The judge suspected corruption in that and did not yet go along. So Trump just pardoned Flynn himself.
Yes, Trump pardoned Flynn. He didn't say why in his tweet, although this was not a surprise. This was a move that was expected. And of course, we know that the president has for a long time railed against the Russia investigation and against Flynn's prosecution. The White House put out a statement last night about this pardon. It repeated a lot of the president's views on Flynn. It claimed that Flynn was an innocent man, said that he never should have been prosecuted, also claimed that Flynn was the victim of a plot to try essentially to kneecap Trump and his presidency. Of course, those are allegations that President Trump himself has made about the Russia investigation for years.
How are the president's allies responding to the president's use of one of his most awesome powers in a case where he had a personal interest?
Well, it's interesting. The Flynn case and the general here has become a rallying cry of sorts for Trump and his base and his allies on the Hill for quite some time. They welcomed this pardon of Flynn. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, for example, who, of course, is a good ally of the president, called this a good pardon by the president. Democrats, on the other hand, look at this as an abuse of the president's pardon power. The Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, said Trump is using the pardon power here to reward his friends and political allies and protect those who cover up for him.
Can we expect more pardons?
I think we can. I think there's every reason to expect that the president will use his pardon power again before he leaves office. And there's a long list of associates that Trump may decide that he wants to pardon out of a legal jam. His one-time campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, for example, who was sentenced to more than 7 years in prison. There's also Steve Bannon, his former strategic advisor, who's under federal indictment in New York. And then, of course, there's the possibility that Trump could pardon members of his family or even decide to try to pardon himself.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
On this very different Thanksgiving morning, we have a couple of numbers for you. More than 12.7 million people have been infected with COVID-19 in the U.S. so far. More than 262,000 have died. The coronavirus has left many families with an empty seat at the dining room table today.
Yeah, and for a holiday that celebrates holding loved ones close, we are grappling with how to find comfort in the middle of this pandemic. In Phoenix, Arizona, at Lisa Garcia's house, Thanksgiving was always a major event.
I'm originally from Colombia, and my husband, Ramiro, is from Mexico. And so what we do is we have huge, like, tamale party, and we've had piñatas, and 40-plus people.
40-plus, normally, but this morning, the house is quiet. Her husband, Ramiro Garcia, is a hospitalist. That's a physician who works exclusively in a hospital who's been treating COVID-19 patients since March.
And today, he is right back there on the front lines.
He'll be working the COVID unit, so it's the reality. It's just trying to manage all the seriousness of it, you know.
Now, since visitors are not allowed on his floor, Garcia says her husband will be one of the few people these patients are actually going to see on this Thanksgiving Day.
On moments like this, they hold their patients' hands a little tighter, a little longer.
And this Thanksgiving, Lisa Garcia is just thankful that her husband can come home.
You know, my family will be here at 4:30 waiting for him. And we're very grateful that we are able to do that.
In Gloucester, Massachusetts, the number of people around Ariane Wolf's table will also be smaller this year. She's asked friends and her elderly father to stay home.
This is very sad, but my father is going to be entirely alone in his house for Thanksgiving, which I believe will be the first time that is the case in his entire life. And he's about 82 years old now.
She knows today is going to be hard without her dad, but Wolf has a 14-year-old son. She can live with being apart on Thanksgiving if it means her dad can watch his only grandchild grow up.
To my father, I would just like to say thank you for being so understanding and knowing that the reason that we're not having you here is because of how much we love you.
We appreciate you listening this morning on your public radio station. You can find all of us who host this program on Twitter. I'm at NPR Green. Noel is at Noel King. Rachel Martin is at Rachel NPR. Steve Inskeep is at NPR Inskeep. But we are just the hosts. There's an entire team of colleagues who do the real work here getting this show on the air. And you can find all of them if you go to npr.org, go over to the Morning Edition page, click on staff, and meet all of our colleagues. You can follow a lot of them on Twitter. They are tweeting things that are a lot more fun and interesting than I am. This is NPR News.
Good morning. You're tuned to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:19. Coming up, some Black Americans can be reluctant to take vaccines. Black doctors and nurses are trying to change that. We'll hear more on this effort and on why many Black Americans don't trust the medical community. That's in about 15 minutes when Reed Tuckson with the Black Coalition Against COVID-19 joins us. Stick around for that conversation.
I'm Demi from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and I donated my 2000 Ford Focus to Wisconsin Public Radio. It lasted 250,000 miles, 18 years. I would listen to public radio every day in that car. I found out about donating my car while I was listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I thought it was only fitting that it should come and stay with you guys.
Find out how you can donate your old vehicle. Go to WPR.org/support and thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Sitka Salmon Shares, a community-supported fishery home delivering traceable wild Alaskan seafood. More about their small boat fleet at sitkasalmonshares.com/WPR.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Their staff can answer your questions about pre-planning a meaningful funeral or memorial service. They consider it an honor to serve families in our community since 1931. KenoshaFuneralHome.com.
Taking a look at the weather forecast, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s around Wisconsin today, and it'll be cloudy, especially in the morning. Tonight, temperatures dropping down into the low to mid 30s. Tomorrow, much of the same, though more sun and less clouds expected, highs in the mid-30s to low 40s. Clear skies in the evening with highs in the 20s. You're listening to news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Find more online at WPR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, who believes their clients' drive will never run out, nor will TIAA's commitment to not only get clients to retirement, but through it. TIAA.org/neverrunout. From Little Passports, offering hands-on activity kits to keep kids engaged and expand their minds, designed to help kids to explore the world and unpack the mysteries of science. More at littlepassports.com. And from Olive, an AI solution built for healthcare, dedicated to being all in and always on, so patients and healthcare workers get the care they need. Learn more at olivecares.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. This morning, we are remembering one of the greatest sports stars of all time. Diego Maradona died on Wednesday at the age of 60. He reportedly had a heart attack. The Argentine was one of the greatest soccer players in history. At the 1986 World Cup, he scored what is often called the goal of the century. Genius, 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 that commentator is screaming as Maradona weaves his way through England's defense. Now, minutes before that, he scored arguably the most controversial goal in soccer history using his hand. And that sort of summed him up. A magician, a maverick, always in the headlines. Filmmaker Richard Sanders knew the man personally. He was part of the production team that brought us Maradona Kicking the Habit, a film that told his story. And he interviewed the soccer great on a number of occasions, and he's with us now. Richard, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what made Maradona so special on the soccer field?
He had a combination of everything. He had an extraordinary pace. He had extraordinary skill. He was also a wonderfully intelligent and instinctive football player. And he was a wonderful team player as well. You know, none of his teammates had a single bad word to say against him. He was a wonderful team player.
But I mean, he was known for his activities off the field as much as his soccer playing. And his life was complicated, if we can use that word. I mean, can you talk to us about some of what he went through?
So the film I worked on 20 years ago, we filmed in Cuba and in Buenos Aires. Now, Maradona at that time was only just 39. He hadn't stopped playing that long before, but he was already having problems with his heart. He'd had a stroke or a minor heart attack or whatever. And he was in Cuba to rehabilitate, to try and kick his cocaine habit. That was the fundamental problem Diego had. He was addicted to cocaine. And as he always said, you know, imagine how good a player I'd have been if I hadn't been addicted to cocaine. And in a strange way, the whole of Argentinian self-respect to a degree began to rest on Maradona. And I think Diego struggled with that.
But not everyone rooted for him. I mean, he was beloved by so many people, but also loathed by many. I mean, what was the fascination? What was the draw to this man for so many people?
Well, of course, you're talking to an Englishman, and I think if he's loathed anywhere, it's in England because of the famous, the infamous Hand of God goal in 1986. Even here, though, I think most people would recognize that the beauty of the second goal outshines the problems with the first goal.
And for an Englishman to admit that is pretty significant.
I mean, I talked to Diego about this. The key thing with Maradona is he took very ordinary teams to the heights. Now, the game against England is the absolute cornerstone of the legend. The thing about that quarterfinal is, of course, it comes 4 years after the Falklands War between Britain and Argentina. Now, all the talk before the game was, of course, this is nothing about the war. This is about sport. It's not about politics. But I remember talking to the Argentinian commentator you were quoting earlier, who actually commentated on that game. And he said to me, of course it was all about the war. How could it not be about the war? And to gain sort of national revenge against England through the combination of the greatest goal ever scored in a World Cup, and it certainly is, and cheating was almost too perfect to be true for some Argentinians. Diego articulated this perfectly to me when I interviewed him 20 years ago. He said, in Argentina, we rather admire the pickpocket, the street kid who gets away with it, who picks your pocket and no one sees. And I said to him, Diego, we all saw, everyone saw, it was just the referee and the linesman who didn't see. Huh. And he just grinned at me, but that was Diego.
Well, Richard, thanks so much for talking to us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We were speaking to Richard Sanders about soccer star Diego Maradona, who has died. Richard's film was called Maradona Kicking the Habit.
Okay, every fall, the Oxford English Dictionary picks a word of the year. It's something that captures the way the English language changed in those 12 months.
In 2013, the word of the year was selfie. In 2015, it was just a crying, laughing emoji. Those were simpler times, weren't they?
This year, when we did the same thing that we always do and looked at a bunch of words and looked back at all of our data, it was very overwhelming.
Overwhelming, I'm sure. That is Catherine Connor Martin, an editor with the Oxford English Dictionary.
She says in this strange and unprecedented year, they couldn't settle on just one word. So for the first time ever, they chose a bunch. Coronavirus is on the list. And at one point near the beginning of the pandemic, Martin says we were using that word as much as the most common English noun.
It was coming up at a similar level of frequency as the word time. It ended up affecting how we talked about everything.
We also learned once clinical words like PPE and N95. Another word that has made the list, doom scrolling. You know, when you're staring at your phone in the middle of the night reading all of the bad news.
That was a neologism this year. And it is simultaneously a word that is about the pandemic, but also a word that is about everything else.
So let's move on to everything else. January saw spikes in the words bushfire and impeachment. Remember when those were big news? Remember when impeachment was supposed to be the biggest news of the year? As the year dragged on, new stories brought new vocabulary.
That's right. Racial justice protests over the summer prompted the addition of Black Lives Matter to the list. And then there was that big thing that happened earlier this month.
You started to see things like in-person voting, these new phrases that weren't salient things to say before.
The dictionary released its report on the many words of the year this week, and Catherine Connor Martin sees at least one silver lining.
This language has gone wild. It's done so many things, and we've all kept up with it. And I think nothing shows you more the elasticity, the creativity, just like the wonders of language use than that kind of situation.
Yes, wonderful. We've all adapted our language. Now here's to 2021 being the kind of year that has just one word of the year. This is NPR News.
2020 has been a tough year for the restaurant industry, and many are trying to survive the pandemic in any way they can.
You just pivot. How can you add value and keep your business afloat? If that means I got to make cannolis for 1,000 people a day, then that's what I have to do.
How restaurants are reinventing themselves for Thanksgiving. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio, and the latest news from WPR is just ahead. We'll hear more about the fate of the largest paper mill in central Wisconsin. That plus an update on the coronavirus outbreak in the state. Stay tuned. All of that is coming up after news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Many airports across the U.S. have been crowded this week despite calls from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for Americans to stay home over the Thanksgiving holiday due to the coronavirus. Among those flying on Thanksgiving Eve was a physician. Dr. Marcella Young says she and her family members weren't overly worried about boarding a plane at Boston's Logan International.
It's not going to be a big group. It's going to be a small group. So we feel pretty safe.
California reported a record number of daily infections yesterday at more than 18,000. The Thanksgiving holiday is being celebrated today aboard the International Space Station. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce has more.
The orbiting space station currently has a crew of seven from the U.S., Russia, and Japan, including NASA astronaut Mike Hopkins.
You know, for me, Thanksgiving is all about family. And it's from the time I was a little kid till now, we've always spent Thanksgiving together. On this particular Thanksgiving, though, it's going to be a little bit different because I'm spending it with my international family.
The astronauts have the day off. They'll be able to watch football and make calls down to folks on Earth. They also have traditional food like turkey and stuffing, although it's all in pouches and thermostabilized or freeze-dried. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. It's 8:31. I'm Hannah Haynes. The owner of the largest paper mill in central Wisconsin is pausing its plans to sell the facility. The news about the Verso Mill in Wisconsin Rapids leaves nearly 900 laid-off workers in limbo. Rob Menser has more.
Verso idled the Wisconsin Rapids Mill in July, laying off the vast majority of workers. The century-old mill has long been central to both the city's economy and its identity. Paul Fowler is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. At a virtual panel discussion, he said Verso's CEO blamed the pandemic.
Now they're kind of slowing down, taking a pause on Wisconsin Rapid because, in his words, it's very difficult to deal with the mills in these times.
The announcement leaves workers even more unsure about the mill's future. State and federal elected leaders have called on Verso to push for a sale. In a letter to the company, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin said activist investors are pushing decisions that come at the expense of workers. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
While Thanksgiving celebrations may look different due to the pandemic, holiday food prices have remained mostly steady. An annual survey of grocery stores by the Wisconsin Farm Bureau found an average Thanksgiving meal for 10 people cost just under $61 this year. That's about 60 cents less than in 2019. Turkey was one food that saw a price decline, coming in at about 7% lower than last year. Sarah Hetke from the Wisconsin Farm Bureau says retailers are hoping to entice customers to still buy a turkey, even if it's for a smaller crowd.
We're probably not going to have as many people at the Thanksgiving dinner table, but they're still hoping people will come in and buy those turkeys, make that traditional meal. We just might be eating turkey in some creative ways as leftovers.
The price for ham had the largest increase. It was about 19% higher this year after prices fell in 2019. Wisconsin saw a decline in the seven-day average for new cases of COVID-19 for the fourth straight day yesterday. The State Department of Health Services reported an average of 5,372 new cases over the last week. That's still very high when compared to other points in time during the pandemic. While new cases may be declining, the seven-day average for new deaths from COVID-19 is increasing. 63 additional people died from the disease yesterday. That's a new record high.
And from Carbonite, an open text company working to help prevent data loss. Carbonite now includes WebRoot antivirus for staying resilient against cyber attacks. Learn more at carbonite.com. From Netflix with Dance Dreams Hot Chocolate Nutcracker, spotlighting Debbie Allen and following her Dance Academy as they prepare for Allen's annual twist on the classic holiday production, streaming on Netflix November 27th. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A public health announcement, which you can see online, describes itself as a love letter to Black America.
Dear Black America, we love you. We affirm that Black lives matter.
On the screen, you see images of Black doctors and nurses and other medical workers. The YouTube video comes from the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. Doctors and nurses, leaders of academic institutions. Dr. Reed Tuckson is the former health commissioner of Washington, D.C.
One of the things that we have noticed about the response to this COVID pandemic has been the level of mistrust and misinformation that has plagued the response to this virus. As a result of that distrust and misinformation, there is a reluctance on the part of many Americans, but particularly Americans of color, to follow the guidance that has been offered, and also a very great reluctance to be willing to participate in the clinical trials for the vaccine and for accepting a vaccine once safe and proven. So what we are trying to do with this effort is to speak directly to this fundamental issue of distrust and misinformation that results in, unfortunately, premature death and preventable misery and suffering.
Let's think that through, because as you know very well, distrust of experts is a universal issue today. Distrust of science, distrust of doctors, and particularly distrust of vaccines. Every kind of person may exhibit that behavior. But what particularly seems to be happening in communities of color?
One of the things that I had the chance to do in my career was to be the Commissioner of Public Health in the District of Columbia during the height of the HIV epidemic. And there we found that it was extremely difficult to break through the legacy of the Tuskegee syphilis experience and other significant insults that had made it very difficult to be able to push our message through around the appropriate things to do. It is amazing to me now that in 2020, so many years later, the same issues are rearing their head. Certainly, this is a national issue, but in the African-American community, it is a particularly exacerbated issue because of things like the Tuskegee experience, and combined with efforts that have resulted in the need for thousands and thousands of people of color to walk into their city streets and declare that their lives matter. When you have that level of anxiety, that causes a significant problem in healthcare.
When you're talking about people saying Black Lives Matter, of course, that's a reference to policing. When you say the Tuskegee experience, will you describe that for people for whom maybe that's just a name?
Back in the 1930s, there was a trial that evaluated what will happen if you inject syphilis into human beings and then decide not to treat them, but just follow along and see what the course of the events would occur. Even though there was a treatment, these victims were unable to access that. And there simply was a watching as these people became ill, sickened, and died. This legacy is so outrageous that it has remained prominent, unfortunately, even today. And that is the kind of symbolic issue combined with other elements in the society that have caused too many people of color to be distrustful of the vaccine process, the clinical trials process, and as a result, their health will suffer and we will pay the consequences.
I noticed in watching this public service announcement, this love letter to Black America, it is one Black face after another. It is African Americans in scrubs, doctors, nurses, other medical professionals.
That is true. And I think that the reason is that I think too few people in the Black community realize, first of all, that how many African Americans are in leadership positions, who are in positions of authority and power to be able to make sure that something like Tuskegee could never happen again. So that the head of the National Heart and Lung Blood Institute at the NIH is an African American man. One of the people that is doing the most important basic science about the vaccine in Tony Fauci's lab is an African American woman. And there are also Black physicians who are involved very intimately in the review process at the FDA prior to the making a final decision on safety and efficacy. So we are trying to absolutely let our community understand that we are inside of the tent, watching everything very carefully, protecting their interests and assuring them that only the best science is being applied to the decisions that will affect their life.
I wonder if it's helpful to a doctor or a nurse just to be alive to the history, just to know the history that might be in the head of the other person, the patient that they bring into that room.
I was well trained as a physician, and one of the things that was a hallmark of my training was to learn to listen to the patient and connect with the patient to their history, their culture, their ideas, their values, their spirituality, all of the elements that make them a unique and vital human being. And so it is imperative that we know this history, that all health professionals understand what your patient is bringing to the clinical arena. Health professionals have to understand how and why people make decisions if we're going to help people to make the most appropriate decisions for them.
Dr. Reed Tuckson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
He's one of the organizers of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19.
The celebrity chef Vikas Khanna has a Michelin star. He's based in New York. He's cooked for presidents and royals. But this year, he has been feeding the hungry in his home country, India. Here's NPR's Lauren Freyer.
When India went into coronavirus lockdown last spring, poor laborers got stranded without work. Some starved to death, including a woman on a train platform. Someone recorded this video of the woman's toddler trying to wake her up. It went viral, and Vikas Khanna saw it.
That pushed me so hard, I can't tell you. If a chef is not broken by hunger, then there's no other reason for us to be in this industry.
In a panel discussion last week, Khanna described how he used his huge Twitter following to organize food giveaways across India. PepsiCo and other big companies pitched in. They partnered with Indian disaster relief forces and thousands of volunteers. Khanna's living room in New York morphed into an international logistics center.
The entire walls are filled up with paper charts trying to organize cities.
From thousands of miles away, he set up kiosks at gas stations giving away hot meals and sent pickup trucks to drop bagged lunches for children in the street. Khanna says some in the West assume he grew up hungry himself, and that's not the case.
I come from Amritsar, and we have rituals in which we don't let anyone sleep hungry.
Sikh temples there give out free meals. By last month, Khanna had managed to organize more than 50 million free meals in 125 Indian cities. He's become even more of a role model. In Delhi, a little girl won second place at a school costume competition dressed up in a chef's hat.
My idol is Chef Vikas Khanna. I want to be like him.
My idol is Chef Vikas Khanna, she says in a clip posted on Twitter by her family. And she's wearing a sash that reads, Bake the World a Better Place. Lauren Freyer, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning, it's 8:42 right now. Coming up on Morning Edition, the BBC is launching a new audio tool that uses artificial intelligence to read articles from its website aloud, claiming it's cracked the code with a voice that speaks in a friendly, easy-to-understand Northern British accent. We'll have more on that story in about 9 minutes.
We can all make a difference and help stop the spread of COVID-19. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services urges all of us to wear a mask, wash our hands frequently, limit gatherings, and maintain social distance every time we go out. Working together, we can help save lives. Learn more about COVID safety, including information about the location of testing sites near you, at dhs.wisconsin.gov.
Support for WPR comes from All of Us Wisconsin, dedicated to helping speed up health research breakthroughs by asking 1 million people to share health information. Details at joinallofus.org/Wisconsin.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. A cultural asset and a community resource, WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College, with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
Just a bit more Morning Edition ahead today before we transition over to Thanksgiving programming. And join us for that programming with music and stories for the holiday. At 1 o'clock, we'll hear Giving Thanks, a program featuring classical music and stories of Thanksgiving. It's a celebration of fall, food, and gratitude. That's today at 1. You can learn more about all of our holiday specials at wpr.org/holidays. In the weather forecast, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s around the state today. It'll be cloudy with a chance for some sun in the afternoon, and then temperatures dropping down into the low to mid 30s this evening.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3. C3.ai software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai. And from Total Wine & More, where in-store teams can recommend a bottle of wine, spirit, or beer for the holidays. Shoppers can explore more than 8,000 wines, 2,500 beers, and 3,000 spirits. More at TotalWine.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We've had nearly 9 months of the pandemic to get this right, and still, many healthcare workers do not have the personal protective equipment that they need. Will Stone reports.
There are days when ER nurse Rachel Heinz leaves her shift certain it couldn't get worse.
And yet somehow it is just a little bit worse every single time.
Heinz works in Bismarck, North Dakota, where hospitals have been buckling under the unrelenting flood of COVID patients for weeks.
There are times when you feel like I should be in four different places at once. People's lives are hanging on and I can't even check if their oxygen level is okay or check if their airway is okay. Like just the basic, make sure that they're still alive.
Not everywhere is quite as bad as North Dakota, but many places are starting to look that way. More than 1,000 hospitals are critically short on staff. And the fears among healthcare workers are familiar. Not enough people and not enough personal protective equipment.
We are still wearing N95s for the entirety of our shift, whether that's 12 hours or the other day I worked a 16-hour shift.
Before the pandemic, that would be unheard of. These N95 masks shield against tiny airborne droplets, and they're only supposed to be used once. But now, Heinz considers herself somewhat lucky. She even gets one per shift. Mary Turner, who works in a COVID ICU, is president of the Minnesota Nurses Association.
I have nurses in Minnesota that still wear their masks 8 to 10 shifts.
Shortages of PPE aren't quite as widespread as during the spring. Some states have stockpiles, but there's huge variability, and it's difficult to track. There's not enough funding, domestic manufacturers still can't keep up, and there are ongoing issues with the global supply chain. Dr. Shikha Gupta is with the nonprofit Get Us PPE.
We simply don't have the supply that we need to match the demand that we're going to see over the coming months.
She says even big academic hospitals are starting to reuse PPE. It's not just masks. She says soon even gloves will be really hard to find.
We could have learned from our mistakes, but we haven't.
Often, healthcare workers on designated COVID units are the only ones hospitals can give N95 masks. Maria Gray is a nurse in one of Missouri's worst hotspots. Not long ago, she spent 2 days with a patient who then later tested positive.
I have to listen to their lungs. I have to listen to their heart. But we're not issued N95s in that unit, even though technically we're being exposed.
Luckily, she didn't get infected, but she worries. They're already strapped for help and cases are rising fast.
The house is full almost every night. We're like right at the beginning.
Even places where it's not quite as dire yet, healthcare workers already feel the strain. Cindy Frank is a nurse in Bremerton, Washington. Over the summer, Frank's hospital had an outbreak of COVID. More than 70 staff and patients got infected. Several people died.
And now the staff is just stressed out. They don't have any competence.
Nurses are quitting. It's just a real mess.
And for some healthcare workers, concerns go beyond PPE and staffing. Jessica Scarlett, a travel nurse, is still recuperating after 3 months of caring for no one but COVID patients at a hospital in Texas.
I needed a break emotionally and physically. You could just see the fear in their eyes. There was one guy, he would always say, "Please sit with me, I'm really scared." The day before I left, he was intubated.
Scarlett says she may take another assignment, as long as there's adequate PPE. But this time, it will only be for a few weeks. For NPR News, I'm Will Stone.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:49 now, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. WPR will have special Thanksgiving programming for you this morning and afternoon, including this year's Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concert. It will feature performances by students around the state, and this year, for the first time ever, the concerts were held virtually. Tune into that beginning at 10.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the United Way of Kenosha County is looking for volunteers to assist with the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program from January to April 10th. Offered at multiple locations in Kenosha County, visit KenoshaUnitedWay.org/VITA.
WPR is proud to support the power of listening. Find out how to record your story at StoryCorps.org/participate.
Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on this Thanksgiving morning. In weather, highs in the upper 30s to mid 40s around the state today, and it'll be cloudy in most areas. Tonight, temperatures dropping down into the low to mid 30s. And then tomorrow, similar to today's weather, but it might be a little bit more sunny with less clouds around, highs in the mid 30s to low 40s, clear skies in the evening with highs in the 20s. You're listening to WPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. The BBC is one of the world's most recognized broadcasters. Maybe you've heard this before.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London.
But when the BBC wanted to step up its audio game online, it wanted a more informal, friendlier voice than that. So it turned to artificial intelligence. NPR tech correspondent Shannon Bond introduces us to their newest sound.
I'm the BBC's synthetic voice, and I can read out articles from BBC.com.
This is the first time I'm meeting this voice, which I'm sorry to say doesn't have a name. The BBC told me I could ask it anything, so I asked it to explain how it works.
It's easy. I take the text that's on the screen and read it out loud. Well, okay, maybe it's not quite that simple. There's a lot of tech going on in the background.
The BBC developed the voice with engineers at Microsoft using machine learning.
They based it on many hours of human recordings and finally tuned it to create the voice you hear now. Pretty clever, eh?
A lot of publishers are trying these experiments to turn text into speech, to make their websites and apps accessible for people who have a hard time seeing, and to keep people engaged, even if they're too busy to sit down and read. So the BBC did a lot of research and decided to shed one of its best-known traits, the very proper accent known as the Queen's English.
Here is the Air Ministry's weather forecast for tomorrow.
Online, the BBC wanted a voice that's more easygoing, one you could imagine having a pint with.
I'm British, so I say tomato, while you say tomato. I'm also Northern, aka not from London, so I say bath, while the Queen of England might say bath.
Bath, bath. Okay, that might not sound like a big deal to American ears, but on the other side of the pond, it really matters.
In the UK, Northerners are known for sounding friendly. I hope I do too.
That tone also sets the BBC apart from the audio technology other news organizations are using.
This is your Washington Post election 2020 results update. I'm Claire, elections AI presenter for the Post.
Claire is all business, no drama. At the other end of the spectrum, there's the New York Times.
Black theater is having a moment. Thank Tyler Perry. Seriously.
The Times bought a company this year called Autumn, which produces audio stories with professional voice actors. The BBC is aiming for somewhere in the middle. Here's what its voice sounds like reading a recent story.
But when the office temporarily closed 8 months ago due to the pandemic, Domino wasn't wistful about losing his daily dose of corporate culture, The View or free kombucha.
So now, when you might think about flipping on the radio or a podcast, the BBC hopes you'll try out a news story or a feature.
Life can get busy, so I can help by reading articles out loud, letting you get on with other things at the same time. You might need to go for a run, pick the kids up from school, or make supper, which, I believe, Americans call dinner.
But do people really want to listen to a robotic voice, even a friendly one? I asked Nick Kwa, who writes the audio industry newsletter Hot Pod. He says that depends on whether the AI can fool you into thinking it's a real person.
Can it be an automated delivery of information that doesn't feel mechanical, that feels vaguely believable as a source of, like, you know, that intimacy that people look for in the audio format?
And when it comes to that question, we humans still have an edge over the robots. Just ask Siri.
Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Every year before Thanksgiving, sorry, I was trying to sound like an AI voice there. Every year before Thanksgiving, the American Farm Bureau sends volunteer shoppers into grocery stores. They note the prices of the ingredients that go into Thanksgiving dinner. Cardiff Garcia and Patty Hirsch from NPR's podcast The Indicator from Planet Money discovered the cost of Thanksgiving is going down.
The American Farm Bureau is a group that represents farmers throughout the country. And in its annual survey, it found that the average cost of Thanksgiving dinner for 10 people this year is $46.90.
And the Farm Bureau's chief economist, John Newton, says that figure is low, really low.
That's down 4% from what we saw last year, and actually is the lowest level that we've seen since 2010.
And that's without adjusting for inflation. We asked John if he could tell us how the cost of Thanksgiving dinner has changed when he does adjust for inflation.
And specifically, what we wanted to know was if it was possible that Thanksgiving dinner was actually the cheapest it had ever been since the survey was started back in 1986.
Wait, let me power up my spreadsheet just to make sure.
Sure. Go for it. Yeah, check it out.
Yes, it is. It is the lowest that it's been in 35 years.
Wait a minute. What did you just tell me?
That in inflation-adjusted dollars, Thanksgiving dinner is going to be the lowest it's been in 35 years.
Aren't you stunned?
You know, I am, actually. I don't know why I didn't look at that particular statistic before you asked me.
So John says that you basically have to understand two stories to also understand why Thanksgiving dinner is so cheap this year.
Okay, so here's the first story. What happened this year? The ingredient with the biggest decline in its price is the turkey.
Turkey prices came in at $1.21 per pound. That was down 7% from what we saw last year, which means you can put a 16-pound bird on the table for less than $20 this year.
And this could be partly because the pandemic has forced families not to gather together in the same big groups as they normally would. So there's just less demand for those big turkeys that families usually buy. And it's also because a lot of grocery stores have discounted the price of turkey, frankly, just to get people through the door.
According to the Department of Agriculture, more than 80% of retailers were running promotions across the country when we started this survey. So you'll see turkey prices that range anywhere from 29 cents a pound to, you know, $2.99 a pound, depending on what type of grocer you're in.
And then there's the second, the longer term story to tell. And this is actually an easy one to explain. Because of new technologies and innovations in how to produce food, over the last few decades, farmers have simply become better at it, more efficient, which means that they can sell the food for cheaper.
You've got to recognize that we benefit from a high quality and very affordable food supply. You know, we spend a small percentage of our disposable income on food. Food in the United States is very affordable.
Now, John and the Farm Bureau, of course, represent farmers, so he's boosting his peeps there a little bit. But the general story that the agricultural sector in the U.S. has become more and more efficient over time is definitely true.
Patty Hirsch,
Cardiff Garcia, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab. Charles Schwab is committed to offering a modern approach to wealth management with personalized financial planning to meet an investor's specific needs. Learn more at schwab.com/plan.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Support for WPR comes from Bernie's Rock Shop in Bernie's on Park. Two distinctive stores offering a variety of gems and jewelry. 901 East Johnson and 636 Park Street in Madison. Holiday shopping hours are at Bernie's Facebook page.
I'm Gregory Berg, encouraging you to subscribe to the new Morning Show podcast, which can be found on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts, to receive a different Morning Show 7 days a week. Remember to search for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News.